أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد الله.
Welcome to another segment of the Islam in Focus program. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have a fourth program in our new series dealing with the sources of Islam. We'll be continuing with our very interesting discussion of the authorship of the Quran. This is our third program dealing with this topic. I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Could I have you, as is our fashion, very quickly go back to the second program on this topic of authorship of the Quran and very quickly highlight the main points that we touched on last week?
Certainly. We continued with this question of verification of the Prophet Muhammad's claim that the Quran is not his, he did not author it, and he received it directly as a revelation from God through Angel Gabriel. And we indicated to start with that his own witness should be enough, because usually people claim things that doesn't belong to them rather than the opposite, and it's strange to say you have to prove that you're not the author rather than prove that you are the author. We also examined the possibility that he might have claimed the authorship of the Quran in order to benefit materially from that, and we indicated that by examining his life and assets before he was a prophet and afterwards, you'll find that he became much worse off. He didn't have any financial worries, he was married to a rich woman, he has lots of wealth, but we find that he lived like any poor person until he died. And we indicated that this simple life continued even after lots of wealth was already available under his fingertips at his disposal, but he self-imposed this kind of discipline on himself. So why do that if there's no benefit? In the last part of the program, another question was raised as to whether even if a person is not pursuing material benefit, that he might have been looking for some power and leadership. And we indicated again that people who look for prestige and power also look for wealth in order to show off that power. And secondly, by examining some examples of his life, there are many others that confirm the same thing, we saw that he was a very, very simple, very humble individual. He forbade his people from even over glorifying him. So it appears then that the grounds for claiming either material benefit or egotistic needs, it doesn't seem to have a very strong foundation, does it?
Mm-hmm. Well, we closed off our program last time examining some of the information from the Quran which would indicate that Prophet Muhammad didn't have any aspiration for power or for leadership. Right. I'm wondering if we could pursue that a little bit further and perhaps examine the historical record to determine if there's anything there which would document or show us that the Prophet didn't aspire to leadership and power and authority.
Okay. Well, we all know historically that he began his career as a prophet at the age of 40. So from birth to the age of 40, if there were any aspiration to power or preparation for leadership, a person would have expressed that in some way or the other. So the evidence here is to the opposite. Is there any historical evidence that he did in fact prepare himself or aspire to be a leader or deliverer, as some people might call, for his people? Usually a person would express that desire, if not in public, at least to those who are closest to him. For example, to his beloved wife Khadija, with whom he lived for a quarter of a century. Now, if the person also was looking for leadership or power, you should go about it the right way. Example, nowadays, if a person wants, for example, to be a president or prime minister or whatnot, he's got to get into the political process, get himself nominated in whatever municipal, provincial, or federal, whatever positions, and show his ability so that down the line, sometimes in the future, people would appreciate that he's a good politician or somebody who, you know, deserves that leadership. Now, what was the analogy of that at the time of the Prophet? They used to have in Quraysh, which was the leading tribe from which the Prophet came, they have a place called Darun Nadwa. It's almost like a place for consultation, which is analogous here to our, you know, representative body, people who really are the leaders of their people. Now, there is no record that he used to go there and sit and discuss with them and show his ability. He shunned that, and instead he, towards the end of this period before he became prophet, go to the mountain, isolated by himself, to contemplate and think and pray that he would be guided to the path of truth. Well, if he was seeking political power, he was going about it the wrong way, and that's the way. It's not the way to seek political power or leadership. Not only this, there is another important and I hope logical reason to believe that he never aspired for that. Because it is known that when the first revelation came to him while contemplating and meditating in the cave of Hira outside of Mecca, he came down trembling, and that was reported by many, including his wife. He came trembling and very afraid. Now, if a person aspires or expects to be a prophet or leader or whatnot, he would come very happy and proud that his hopes have finally been achieved, and now there is justification because he claims now that the prophet, the angel came to him to declare that he is a prophet. Why did he come afraid? It means that he didn't have any thought even or expectation that he would be in that position to play that important role in human history. Even after this initial experience of the first revelation, when the revelation came to him, many of his companions reported, who have seen that firsthand, that even in the day, which is very cold day, when the revelation came to him, he was so tense that he would be even sweating. Now, a person who is looking for power and ego would try to be composed. You know, one of the weaknesses of politicians, if they cry or show any lack of control. So if he wanted that, and if he was really the author of the Quran, why go through all that? He can simply sit or stand there like a big orator, very comfortable and very composed, and tell people. But that again shows that it was something despite of himself. I'd like to add one more point here also, that which relate both to this question and the question raised towards the end of the previous program, that whether he was looking for material benefit or egotistic or power, both of these assumptions cannot really stand firm, for a simple reason that without the agony that he's gone through, without the hardship and the risk to his life and the difficulty he and his companions have gone through, he could have easily attained all kind of wealth and power that he would have ever thought of without these sacrifices, if this was truly his motive.
Could you perhaps develop that a little bit and explain how he could have achieved that if he had wished?
Well, historically speaking, we know, at least to start with, that the Prophet and his companions have gone through all kind of suffering because of their mission and because of their belief. They were mocked at, they were persecuted, they were tortured, some even were killed under torture. He himself was hurt a great deal, and you know his story when he went to At-Ta'if, when yes, they threw him with stones and his feet were bleeding. He put himself and his companions and followers in jeopardy in terms of the threat to their lives and livelihoods. Well, with all of this suffering, in the midst of all these difficulties, when there was no hope, at least as measured by any person, any human, when there's no hope apparent that he would succeed or have victory over his adversaries, he received a very interesting offer. A representative of the pagan by the name of Uqbah ibn Rabi'ah came to him and he said, "Listen, you have divided our people, you have caused so much dissension. Let me talk to you about something. Maybe you may be willing to accept some of my suggestions." He said, "Say." He said, "Listen, if you, Muhammad, is doing that because you want some wealth, stop it. We will collect all kind of money for you so that you will be the richest one among all of us. If you are doing that in order to attain leadership, we are willing to appoint you as our leader, and we will never decide on any matter without your approval. If you want to be a king, we will make you a king. We'll crown you as a king if this is what you want. If what comes to you and claim to be a revelation from God is some kind of evil visions or disease or something like that, we are willing to collect money from ourselves so that we can seek some cure for you in order to be able to overcome this difficulty. But please, I plead with you to accept. You know what was his answer to this? Of course, if the prophet was a seeker for power or ego or leadership, here is a golden opportunity. And the price was not much. Just one thing, to stop attacking the wrong beliefs that they have or the idol worship. He used to accept the legitimacy also of their worship and worship God. He can worship Allah as he wishes and believe in the one God and everything. But just don't make dissension. Don't try to convince people of your ways or your beliefs. What did he do to that opportunity? His answer was very revealing. We don't have time to go through the entire portion that he answered, but that appears in Surah 41 in the Quran, especially the first 38 verses. He didn't reply on his own, he replied from the word of God itself. That it says basically that this Quran has been sent to people carrying or bringing glad tidings and warning to those who reject, but many of them turned away as if they don't hear. And they said, our hearts are concealed from hearing what you say, and so on. It went on hitting at this basic point that my mission is not really money or ego. I'm only bringing the message of God to you to open your hearts, your minds, and your eyes to the truth. As this offer was, or this incident was not the only one. In fact, after that failed, next time they didn't even send one, they sent him a deputation. Representative, a group of the most noble representatives of his people, to plead with him again, and they basically made the same offer. They say, if you want money, we'll give you money. Leadership, we'll do that. This, give all kind of offers to him, just to compromise a little bit. And again, his answer that time, he said, listen, I did not bring this message. I did not come up with this teaching on my own. Nor did I do that in the pursuit of your money or respect or leadership or to become a king, but it is God who sent me as a messenger to you, and he has given me a book, that is the Quran. He revealed that unto me, so I am only and simply communicating and conveying the message of my Lord and advising you. Now, if you accept my advice, this will be your luck and your share in this life and in the hereafter. If you reject it, then I will be patient until Allah or God decides between you and me. Even prior to these two incidents, they tried to use the psychological pressure on the Prophet. They sent him his most beloved uncle, Abu Talib. He loved the Prophet so much, and the Prophet loved him so much. And Abu Talib, his uncle, used to be a protector of him. He used really to try to press the pagans not to hurt him much. And then he said, my cousin, you have caused this and this, and you're causing us so much problems. Please, it's again trying to plead with him, just to ease it a little bit. What was his answer? An exemplary answer. As narrated in Ibn Hisham, a biography about the Prophet, peace be upon him, the Prophet said, oh my uncle, if they put the sun in my right hand and the moon in my left hand in order for me to give up this mission of mine, I will never do it until I die in defense of that truth, or God decide whatever he pleases. This was his attitude, this was his certitude and fortitude also, in terms of patience and perseverance in carrying his mission. Now, if the Prophet were an imposter, or a person who's seeking material or power, material benefit of power, he could have lived as a king. He didn't have to worship even idols. He could worship as he wishes, but only accept the legitimacy of the wrong beliefs that they had. That evidently shows that his motives were definitely much more nobler than this sort of passing and perishable type of benefits.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last point that you just made raises a related question as to a possible motive for Prophet Muhammad having claimed that God was the source of the Quran, and that might be in order to help reform the people of his time. Do you think that? How would you respond to somebody who might suggest that as a possible motive?
Well, first of all, to reform people, to bring them from darkness to light, is a very noble objective. And that noble objective must be sought also through a noble means also. You can't achieve such a noble objective through fabrication, forgery, or, you know, telling a lie against God. Now, if this assumption were true, just to influence people, why didn't he claim that everything that he said was divine revelation dictated to him verbatim, word for word? Because as we mentioned in the introductory program in this series, we said that even though the Quran was uttered through the tongue of the Prophet, that is totally different from the hadith or his own saying when he's not under the state of revelation or receiving direct communication from Gabriel, word for word. And that these two sources are kept totally separate from each other. Now, if he wanted to influence people, he could have also claimed that everything that he said was dictated to him by Gabriel, word for word, but this didn't happen. Thirdly, people loved him so much and trusted him so much to the point that it did not make much difference to them in obeying him whether he said it's coming from Allah or it's, even if he said it's my saying, they would have followed it. So why did he have to make that meticulous distinction between what he says and what he actually receives and is dictated to him? How could he possibly fabricate or forge a claim that the Quran has come from God or from Allah by way of revelation if he were the author of that Quran, while he day and night recite to the people from that same Quran that the most abominable crime against God is to create a lie against God or to say that God said this when in fact he didn't say that? Mm-hmm. How possibly could that be viable as an assumption?
But could you give us some documentation on that?
You mean this, what the Quran mentions about?
What the Quran mentions about lying about God or Allah?
Okay. Well, for example, in Surah 6, in Ayah 93, it says, وَمَنْ أَظْلَمُ مِمَّنْ افْتَرَى عَلَى اللَّهِ كَذِبًا أَوْ قَالَ أُوحِيَ إِلَيَّ وَلَمْ يُوحَى إِلَيْهِ شَيْءٍ وَمَنْ قَالَ سَأُنْزِلُ مِثْلَ مَا أَنْزَلَ اللَّهِ. That is, and who can be more wicked, the Quran says, than one who invents a lie against God, or say, I have received revelation when nothing was revealed to him, or again, he who says, I can reveal the like of what God revealed or have sent down. It is interesting to notice, if you continue in that citation, that the remaining part actually speaks about the horror and the punishment of those wicked people who claim to have received revelation at the moments of death, when the moment of truth arrives and when they get the bad news through the angels of death, that they will be punished eternally for their lying or creating this false claim about revelation. And that was something that he was reciting to people day and night. In another passage in the Quran, in Surah 69, particularly verses 44 on, it says, وَلَوْ تَقَوَّلَ عَلَيْنَا بَعْضَ الْأَقَاوِيلِ لَأَخَذْنَا مِنْهُ بِالْيَمِينِ ثُمَّ لَقَطَعْنَا مِنْهُ الْوَتِينِ فَمَا مِنْكُمْ مِنْ أَحَدٍ عَنْهُ حَاجِزِينَ. That is, it says, and if he, that is Muhammad, invent any saying in our name, we should have certainly by his right hand and we should certainly then cut off his artery or the artery of his heart, nor could any of you withhold him from our wrath. That the threat is made that any prophet making that false claim, he would be immediately punished. He would die because of claiming this against God. In another citation in 42:24, it says, أَمْ يَقُلُونَ افْتَرَى عَلَى اللَّهِ كَذِبًا فَإِنْ يَشَأِ اللَّهُ يَخْتِمْ عَلَى قَلْبِكَ وَيَمْحُ اللَّهُ الْبَاطِلِ وَيُحَقُّ الْحَقَّ بِكَلِمَاتِهِ وَإِنَّهُ عَلِيمٌ بِذَاتِ الصُّدُورِ. It says, what? Do they say that he, referring to, of course, to Prophet Muhammad, that he has forged a falsehood against God, that is by claiming that the Quran came from God? But if God willed, he would seal up your heart, that is, O Muhammad, and God blots out vanity and proves the truth by his word, for Allah or God knows well the secrets of all hearts. We have to remember also that nothing positive and noble comes through something which is wicked and false, nor does falsehood emanate from a person whose character is such as we have seen in the life and character of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And this is expressed very nicely in the Quran in 16:105. It says, إِنَّمَا يَفْتَرِي الْكَذِبَ الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِآيَاتِ اللَّهِ وَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْكَاذِبُونَ. That is, what kind of people really invent lies against God? They are not believers. It says, it is those who believe not in the signs of God that forge falsehood. It is they who lie. But the person whose basic faith, in the fundamentals of his faith, are based on belief in the one God, the Creator, which includes all moral teachings that you could think of, could not achieve this noble objective by making the worst of all crimes, that is, to lie against God or to claim prophethood or forge a claim that the Quran has come from God.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in your answer, you mentioned that the character of the prophet negated the possibility of forgery. How widely was he, his honesty and his integrity and so on, recognized by his contemporaries?
Well, his lifetime and his reputation was indeed beyond reproach. Let's look at his life between birth and the time when he began his mission as a prophet, at the age of 40. So for 40 years, he was well known with his truthfulness, with his honesty, and with his chastity, to the point that he was given the title Al-Amin, the trustworthy. And that was given uniformly by all people. It was just like a nickname, really, for him. When God ordained him to declare the mission of Islam, because in the initial period it remained rather secret until he really convinced those immediately around him. But when he received God's command to stand up and to invite people in public to Islam or to submission to the will of the Creator, to the one God, he gathered or called on tribes and said, "Oh, children of so-and-so, oh, children of so-and-so," to call all the tribes, "come unto me." And then he stood among them and he said, "Listen, if I were to tell you that behind that hill there are horses, means an army, that is going to invade you, would you believe me?" They all responded, "Ma jarrabna alayka kadiban." That's an interesting statement. They said, "We never experienced you telling a lie. That is, we'll believe in anything you said." He said, "Then I am a warner to you before a severe punishment will come unto you." That's the severe punishment in the Day of Judgment. That is, "I warn you to give up the idol worship and to believe in the one true God and worship him alone." But like I said, the interesting part was the response of all of his people. "Ma jarrabna alayka kadiban." We never experienced you telling a lie. Now, is it reasonable to assume that a person with this character, all his life, not a single lie recorded on him, and all of a sudden, at the age of 40, he starts becoming such a forger that he even lies not on people, but even lies on God and claims falsely that he was receiving revelation. When the first group of Muslims migrated under persecution to Abyssinia, now Ethiopia, and there was a kind and fair king there, the pagans got angry and they sent some of their representatives to retrieve them so that they take them back and persecute them, because they were afraid that their belief might grow and they might attract others. They want to suppress them. And when the king, or the Negus, the king of Ethiopia or Abyssinia at that time, talked to the Muslims, he asked them to explain to him what kind of person was Prophet Muhammad, what did he teach. Their spokesperson, Ja'far, the son of Abu Talib, stood, and one of the things that he said that we were living in darkness, and he mentioned some of the evils that they were doing before the Prophet came, and he said, this man came to us, we know everything about him, we know his lineage, we know his truthfulness. This is something that was prominent in what he said. We know his truthfulness, we know his honesty and chastity, so he taught us and ordered us to worship the one true God alone, to give up idol worship. He taught us to be truthful in what we say, to be honest in our dealing, and to be kind to our relatives, and so on. And when that, again, you find, for example, in biographies about the Prophet like Ibn Hisham. No wonder that these characteristics were something that were the brightest point, actually, that attracted all those who have the goodwill and the intention to follow the truth, simply because of their knowledge of his absolute honesty and truthfulness.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that he was generally recognized by all of that knew him as a person who was truthful and so on. But yet, from some of the passages that you cited a little bit earlier, it seems that some people accused him of fabricating his claim about the source of the Quran. Could you comment on that, explain that?
That's only natural, because there is always enemies of truth.
Yes.
And they always try to resist the truth and try to suppress it. And when they lack any concrete evidence, they start throwing accusations like that. It's quite normal. It happened in the life of all prophets. It happened to Moses. He was accused by all kind of things by the Pharaoh. It happened against Jesus. He was accused by the Israelites. So any truthful and great prophet, when people cannot logically or by good reason keep or drive people away from him, they start just throwing accusations like that. But in all cases, we find that none of the accusers, none, could give any concrete evidence about, logical or otherwise, or historical, that this person actually was lying. And that applies, like I said, to all prophets, also before Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And as I indicated earlier, the historical references mention no single incident, even reported by his own enemies, to say, in such and such situation, he lied. They might say, no, it cannot be possible that he received revelation, so he must be lying, he must be a magician, he must be this. But this, of course, is just like, throwing accusations without justification at all. But the interesting thing that might give some indication even about the attitudes of his own enemies is that in the night when the Prophet was secretly migrating from Mecca to Medina at night, because they were about to kill him, before he left, we are told by historians, he left his son, his cousin Ali, and he said, after I go, please make sure to return back these things that belong to non-Muslims, to his own persecutors.
Mm-hmm.
What does that signify? It means that his own persecutors, the same people who accused him of all kinds of things, in their own heart, they trusted his honesty so much that they chose him to keep their deposits with him. That's why he wanted to make sure that even though he's leaving them, that they will get back their deposits. Another interesting example that was mentioned both in Bukhari and Muslim is that when the Quraysh, the tribe of the Prophet, tried to suppress him by all means, and they couldn't, they went to the Hercules, the Byzantine emperor, and they sent him Abu Sufyan to seek his help against the Prophet and the Muslims. And one of the questions asked by the Roman emperor, he said, did he or was he accused of lying to you before he claimed this prophethood? They said no. He said, did he ever betray his trusts before he claimed prophethood? They said no. And this was a witness given by one of his arch enemies. He was not a Muslim at that time, Abu Sufyan. The same thing again we find in numerous other examples, that the enemies, even before the friends and the companions, could not admit that he is an absolutely honest and truthful person.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, we'll conclude our program for today. We want to thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.